You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
I'm Anna Sale in for Leonard Lopate today. Before Mahatma Gandhi became a national icon in India and a global symbol of nonviolent protest, he was Mohandas Gandhi, a young man educated in London who spent some 20 years of his adulthood in South Africa. Most biographies of Gandhi tend to gloss over this part of his past, framing it as less important than his life and work in India. But Ramachandra Guha's new book shows it was a pivotal time for Gandhi. Two decades in the diaspora gave him the eyes to see and the tools to use when he came back home, writes Ramachandra Guha in the new book, Gandhi Before India. It's published by Alfred Aknopf, and I'm pleased it brings Ramachandra Guha to our studio today. Welcome.
Hi.
You begin your biography, this is the first in a series, with an epigraph from Gandhi's own autobiography. It says, in part, if some busybody were to cross-examine me on the chapters already written, he could probably shed much more light on them. So you are among the busybodies.
I am the busybody.
Who has looked at Gandhi's life.
Yes.
What in this book sheds light on Gandhi's early years that he didn't tell in his version?
Well, I think autobiographies are always partial, selective. And the work of a biographer is not just to fill in the gaps, but to provide the context. You know, how a person evolves his views, his philosophy, his theory of political action, who are his friends, his rivals, his followers, what is the larger historical context. And of course, an autobiographer doesn't really do it. But when it's someone as significant as Gandhi, it's important for the biographer to sketch in that larger context. We're talking about three continents here. We're talking about the history of India, the history of England and the history of South Africa. And I have tried to position Gandhi's life against the tumultuous history of these three continents.
During the turn from the 19th to the 20th
Indeed.
Century. Gandhi was born in 1869. Tell me about his parents.
Well, Gandhi was born in the western port town of Porbandar in present-day Gujarat, in a merchant family, which was austere and vegetarian and extremely pious. His mother was ecumenical in her religious faith. She wasn't a dogmatic Hindu, but she was part of a sect in which verses of the Quran, the Islamic holy text, coexisted with verses of the Gita, the Hindu holy text. His father was an official, a senior official in the local princely state. He was the Diwan, or the chief minister of the prince. And Gandhi was born in Porbandar on the coast and then moved inland to the town of Rajkot, where his father then became the chief minister to the prince of that state. So he had a rather conventional upbringing, but at school, where, as I discovered in my book, he was a rather mediocre student. You know, he was a second-ranking student throughout, which kind of delighted me because I was a second-ranking student myself. But what's interesting is that school, his closest friend was a Muslim. So he's already coming out of his conventional kind of comfort zone in a society which has very rigid caste and religious boundaries. He's making friends across these boundaries even at a very early age.
He marries at a young age, at 13, perhaps even earlier. Tell me about his wife and how that was arranged.
Well, this was customary at that time, that you married young. Your bride was chosen, or your bridegroom was chosen, by your parents. It was a kind of family alliance. So this was also a merchant family of traders from the town of Porbandar. He married early. You know, he was still maturing sexually, psychologically. He talks of how he was fanatically possessive about his wife. He wouldn't let her out of his sight. Of course, as the story evolves, it's a very complicated, anguished relationship. Gandhi, for a long period of time, is an indifferent father, and not very good husband. But over the years, he and his wife Kasturba become adjusted to one another and evolve a kind of companionable marriage.
Before that, as he's a teenager, he's married for 2-3 years. His father takes ill.
Yeah.
What's the impact of Gandhi's father's death on what happens next in his life?
Well, I think there's several things. One, of course, is Gandhi talks in his autobiography of how, when his father was dying, instead of attending to his ailing father, he was so overcome by sexual excitement that he goes back and makes love to his wife, where the news reaches him. And he's tormented by a sense of guilt, which, of course, stays with him for a very long time and explains his later move to celibacy. But the most fundamental kind of consequence of his father's early death is that it leaves Mohandas Gandhi free to evolve his own career path. Gandhi was possessed by the idea of traveling to London to qualify as a barrister. Now, the father was a traditional Hindu patriarch, orthodox, very rigid. According to the caste ethos of the merchant caste, you couldn't travel overseas because to travel overseas was polluting. And in some ways, the father's death liberated Gandhi. When he decided to travel abroad, he could persuade his mother. And I can say, and I'm not sure about America, but Indian mothers are generally easier to persuade than Indian fathers. So it may be true here too. They're more indulgent of their children and more willing to give them more leeway. So, but if his father had been alive, arguably, Gandhi would not have been permitted to qualify as a lawyer in London. He would have been told, you know, you've already finished high school, get a job in India and carry on with your life here. And of course, the history of the world would have been different had Gandhi not gone to London.
That's quite true. He goes to London a month before his 19th birthday. He arrives to train as a barrister. And again, to remind listeners, this is London. This is Great Britain. This is the British Empire is what Gandhi goes on to fight in India. But as he's a young, late teenager, early 20s, what's his experience like in London?
Well, it's fascinating. London is a great international city. I mean, it's got people of many nationalities. It's got a thriving port. It's got industries. Queen Victoria is on her throne. And the young Mohandas Gandhi, 19, goes here. Very early on, he becomes a member of the Vegetarian Society of London. And I argue in my book that those 2 years he spent as an activist with the Vegetarian Society were fundamental to his evolution, not just as a political actor, but also as a moral being. You know, in London, Gandhi learns to befriend people who are not of his religion. You know, he has Christian friends, he has English friends. It's in London that he learns the importance of activism, organized activism, working collectively for a cause. In London, it's to promote vegetarianism. I should add here as a parenthesis that the merchant caste to which Gandhi belonged was vegetarian by custom and convention. Mm-hmm. In London, Gandhi becomes a vegetarian by ethical conviction, not just by temperament or upbringing. So he takes the message of vegetarianism across. His mentor, Henry Salt, is also someone who influences his approach to social change. Henry Salt is an incrementalist who says half a loaf is better than none. So work for slow, steady, incremental change. And that's what Gandhi does all his life. You know, he's not deterred by setbacks, but nor is he a utopian who seeks to turn the world upside down. So it's in London that the seeds of all of this are sown. And it's also in London, while working with the vegetarians, that Gandhi becomes a writer. He makes his debut with a 6-part series in the obscure journal of the Vegetarian Society of London. But that's where he learns to craft an argument, to shepherd and husband facts in a coherent way, to make a case.
And let's talk about the messaging in that series. What was he? His audience is not Indians in London. His audience is wider than that. It's vegetarians of all backgrounds. How does he talk about being an Indian for that audience and vegetarianism from where he comes from?
Well, he talks about the foods of India. He writes a long series about the foods of India, how, what different, commodities are used by Indians, why vegetarianism is important. He talks about shepherds who are vegetarian, but, you know, extremely physically active, strong, to kind of combat the myth that those who don't eat meat are effeminate or weak or whatever. So he's talking about, his traditions of vegetarianism, placing it in a larger context. And I said, learning how to craft an argument, how to persuade, which is, of course, something that he puts to great effect, not just in his legal practice later, but in his political work.
It's also while he's in London that he reads Christian texts and starts thinking about the what the New Testament says about renunciation and how that compares to what the Gita teaches about renunciation. Is that part of his spiritual development as well, this time in London?
To a limited extent. I mean, he's interested in theosophy. He's interested in dissenting Christian churches. But his a fuller moral and spiritual development awaits. Happens only when he goes to South Africa and reads the works of the great Russian writer Leo Tolstoy. So in London, I would say it's more the vegetarianism rather than the spiritual thinking that is crucial.
He returns to India after his training is complete in London, but doesn't stay. What happens in India when he returns and why does he leave?
Well, he returns to India with a law degree in hand. tries to establish himself at the High Court in Bombay, fails, goes to his hometown in Rajkot, gets a few desultory cases, but essentially is a failure and is rescued from professional oblivion and arguably historical oblivion by an invitation from South Africa, where someone, a merchant from his hometown of Porbandar, has gone and prospered and built a big business empire, but is now embroiled in a court case, in a dispute with his cousin and business partner. And Gandhi is called to South Africa to solve one business dispute and eventually stays 20 years.
So he goes for one work engagement, ends up staying 20 years. When he is traveling to South Africa, he immediately sees that the way the society is stratified racially is quite different from his experience in London. What does he see?
Yes, I think what's interesting is that in London in the 1890s, a middle-class Indian experienced little racism because they were, although London was the capital of the British Empire, it was also a city with a vigorous democratic tradition, you know, socialist activism. Karl Marx had just died. George Bernard Shaw was active. The Liberal Party under Gladstone was a very important and formative political force. And Gandhi meets no racial discrimination in London. But when he goes to South Africa, this is a much more harsh and brutal society in which the colonists, both the British who are on the coast in Natal and the Boer or Afrikaners who are interior in the province of Transvaal, obviously the capital is Johannesburg, have much stronger prejudices towards coloured people, towards Africans, of course, who are much more numerous than the Indians, but unlike the Indians, are dispersed in the countryside and not an immediate economic threat to the whites, and of course the prejudice against Indians. So he's confronted with a kind of hostility and unreasoning prejudice which he doesn't experience in London, and he's at first surprised and puzzled by it, which is why for a very long time in South Africa, he's appealing to the imperial authorities in London to make the local colonists see reason and trying to recall them to what he sees as the great and noble and liberal ideals of the British Empire. So it's kind of paradoxical.
He's appealing to the imperial powers.
Yeah.
Yes.
In London, he experiences no discrimination. But in South Africa, of course, not just he, but his fellow Indians and even more so the Africans are treated quite brutally.
And is this where a critique begins to plant the seed of a critique of colonialism begins by seeing the way it's actually executed on the ground in South Africa?
Yes, but it starts very slowly, Anna. It's first a critique only of specific laws. So laws that don't allow Indians to own property in the heart of town because the European shopkeepers don't want Indian traders to compete with them in downtown districts. Laws that prohibit Indians from bringing their brides and generating families. Laws that exclude Indian children from European schools. Laws that prohibit Indians from traveling from one province to another, from Natal to the Transvaal or Natal to the Cape. Laws that do not allow Indians to recruit assistants to help them in their business. So at first, it's a critique not of the large global system of empire, really targeted criticism of specific acts that discriminate against Indians and don't allow them to practice their trade or their livelihood freely.
We will talk more about what that protest looks like after the break. I'm speaking with Ramachandra Guha about the first volume of his biography about Gandhi. It looks at the years Gandhi spent in London and South Africa. It's called Gandhi Before India. It's published by Knopf, and we'll have more after a break. I'm Anna Sale, in for Leonard Lopate today, and I'm speaking with Ramachandra Guha about his new book, Gandhi Before India, about Gandhi's years in London and South Africa. Before the break, you were talking about how Gandhi's critique initially focused on the laws that were targeting Indian immigrants and Indians in South Africa, not a global critique of colonialism in these years. But how did he protest those laws? You make note that he was quite an effective writer, but not such an effective public speaker. So how did he become a leader of protest in South Africa?
Well, he was an effective writer. He edited a weekly journal, which may have been the first multilingual political magazine in the world. It was published in English, Hindi, Gujarati, and Tamil. Because he was a lawyer, he was good at writing petitions, making a case through documents. But eventually he realized that this was getting them nowhere and they needed to undergo collective action. And there was a famous meeting in Johannesburg in 1906, a public meeting at which it was decided that the racially exclusive laws would be disobeyed even if it meant Indians go to jail. Now, as you say, Gandhi was a very poor speaker, but he was a person of great physical courage. And in 1897, he was lynched by a white mob in Durban. And faced this physical anger of a collective white mob with great equanimity and courage. 10 years later, there was an assassination attack on him by Indians in Johannesburg. And I think the ability with which he was able to meet not just polemical abuse in the press or by whites, but also to face physical life-threatening attacks, gave him the confidence that he could motivate and mobilize people. And in the first struggle of 1907-1908, hundreds of people went to jail with him, including many rich merchants. And merchants, Anna, are traditionally a very conservative and risk-averse community. You know, they don't want to give up their business and their trade to go to jail. But Gandhi was inspired and encouraged by the fact that even merchants were willing to abandon their secure businesses to defy racially exclusive laws and follow him.
How did he recruit them? How did he make that case to them that it was worth the risk?
Well, I think, you know, through speaking, through groups, through power of persuasion, and through his own, through the fact that he himself was sacrificing an enormous amount. Gandhi was the first colored lawyer in South Africa, and he'd built up an extremely successful practice because essentially he had the monopoly of the Indian practice. I mean, 100,000 Indians, and he was the only Indian lawyer. And he was extremely wealthy and gave it up. At one stage, the merchants of Natal presented him many gifts, including expensive jewels for his work, and he returned it. And this also impressed people. I think in India, renunciation and sacrifice is something that is greatly cherished. You know, someone who does social service or political work purely for its own reward and not for any monetary gain. So I think he was, through his own exemplary physical courage and his own ability to sacrifice, indeed to abandon a prosperous career, he was able to inspire other people to likewise take the risks and to throw themselves wholeheartedly into the struggle, even if it meant abandoning their families and courting arrest.
So he's first arrested in 1908 in Johannesburg. At that point, had he fully crystallized this idea of, if I am involved in nonviolent civil disobedience, it will have this effect? Had he crystallized the tactical sort of base for what became nonviolent protest?
It happened over a period of time. I think what was happening was that Gandhi realized that, you know, polite petitioning is getting you nowhere. You know, just appealing to higher reason and to the imperial authorities and the benevolence of your white rulers is getting you nowhere. At the same time, he abhorred violence. Already in India, there was a sort of anarchist terrorist movement afoot, where young patriotic Indians, fired by love for their country, thought that if they assassinate British imperial officials, this would ignite a spectacular mass uprising. And Gandhi was skeptical of this, you know, partly because of his religious beliefs, partly because of his commitment to nonviolence. So he forged this technique that was not as submissive as petitioning and not as horrifying and disruptive as violent rebellion. Collective non-violent struggle, where by sacrificing yourself, not by killing the other guy, but by exposing yourself to hardship and suffering, you're drawing attention to the justness of your cause. So, but it happened over a period of time. I mean, it happened, I'd say, his overall philosophy of non-violent struggle. He was also a great tactician. When to start a movement, when to call it off, whom to call, first the merchants, then the workers, when to get women into the nonviolent movement and when to ask women to court arrest, you know. So where to raise funds from, who would be your lawyers who would represent you in court when you were in jail. He was a fantastic strategist too, as well as a moral philosopher. But this happened over a period of time. And South Africa is a laboratory. I mean, one of the reasons I wrote this book is that the theory and practice of nonviolent struggle is really Gandhi's greatest legacy to the world. There are others. I mean, he was a great prophet of interreligious harmony. He was an early environmentalist. He was a wonderful writer. But his greatest contribution is nonviolent civil disobedience, which, of course, he applies to India in the 20s and 30s. And it's a technique that was applied in this country, the civil rights movement. But it... And in solidarity in Eastern Europe by Aung San Suu Kyi in Burma, by the Dalai Lama in Tibet, and countless other examples. But this extraordinarily successful practice of nonviolent civil disobedience was born in South Africa. And I felt in this book, I must explain the origins of this remarkably effective and influential technique worldwide, that the origins and how it took place in South Africa. So I broke up my biography into two. One set in South Africa, and of course the sequel that'll move to India.
What is remarkable is as early as 1907 in South Africa, you said his goals were incremental in India, but he saw the potential of mass nonviolent protest for all oppressed people everywhere. He writes so in 1907, that early on, he can see that this is a method that could be effective in a lot of different contexts.
Yes, I mean, he's prophetic, but it also shows great ambition. Because he's writing to Tolstoy, you know, who's an early mentor of his. Tolstoy is someone from whom he learns the importance of relations of peace and harmony between religions. It's from Tolstoy that he also learns the importance of sacrificing professional success for social activism. But Tolstoy is also a pacifist and an advocate of conscientious objection. And he tells Tolstoy, I've taken your method and I'm perfecting it and I'll make it universally relevant. And it's a striking arrogance because Tolstoy is the greatest Russian novelist of his time, probably of any time. And Gandhi at this stage is a relatively obscure lawyer in Johannesburg, leading a few thousand people. It's not like later in India where he's the leader of millions of Indians in a countrywide struggle. He's dealing what really is a very restricted, a very confined, and in numerical terms, extremely modest social movement. And yet he is telling Tolstoy, I'm going to make your method world famous. Now, it shows supreme confidence. And I suppose political leaders need that.
Yeah. While he's in South Africa, what is Gandhi's relationship with black Africans? How does that fit in with what his work is?
Well, essentially in South Africa, Gandhi is a community leader. He represents the Indians. His attitude towards black South Africans evolves over the 20 years he's there. When he reaches South Africa in 1893, he subscribes to a kind of conventional hierarchy of races in which the Europeans are the most advanced, the Indians are just behind, and the Africans are laggard and backward. But over the years, he abandons these prejudices. He begins by calling Africans kafirs, which is a pejorative term. He drops that. He starts writing about discrimination against Africans. He then says later on in a famous speech in 1908 in Johannesburg that nonviolence is a technique that Africans will use themselves. He never has any close African friends, but he does have African acquaintances. Among them, John Dube, who is the first president of the African National Congress. And the African National Congress, which is founded in 1912, is in part inspired by the work Gandhi has done with Indians. But his views evolve very slowly, and it's only after he returns to India in the 1920s and 30s that he begins advocating a common front between Indians and Africans in South Africa. I mean, that's a story that I'll have to talk about later. And it's also in the 20s and 30s that the pioneers of the civil rights movement in this country, such as Howard Thurman, go to visit Gandhi in India. And, of course, he's extremely receptive to the struggle of African Americans. But in South Africa, though over a period of 20 years, he develops a more critical appreciation of the African predicament, he doesn't really engage with them in any kind of political struggle. He's a leader of the Indian community, period.
I'm speaking to Ramachandra Guha about his volume, Gandhi Before India. It's the first in a series of biographies about Gandhi. And during that time in South Africa, I want to go back to Gandhi's views on Britain and empire. War breaks out in 1899. Where does Gandhi come down on with his alliances with the British?
Well, war breaks out between the British and the Boers, the rival colonists in South Africa. And Gandhi takes the side of the British. He says, I will raise an ambulance corps. You know, the Indians will not fight with arms, but they will provide succor and relief to the wounded. So he raises an ambulance corps for the British. In 1906, war breaks out between the Zulus and the British, and Gandhi does the same thing. So at this stage, he is, in a sense, a loyal imperialist, because he feels that if we want better and kinder and fairer treatment from the British, in that time of need, when they are engaged in a war, we must help them. Not with arms, but at least with medical relief.
Is he thinking about the British treatment of Indians? Or who? Tell me more about the thinking behind that. Why did he want to stay in good with the British at that point?
I think it's partly also because of his family upbringing, where he comes from a family of retainers to the prince. There's a code of obligation and loyalty to the ruler. If the ruler treats you justly, when the ruler is in crisis, you must be loyal to him. You know, that's a kind of code of kingly honor or a feudal honor that Gandhi subscribes to. And part of this spills over in his attitude to the British. And it's only much later in 1919 in India, after the terrible massacre in Amritsar, where British police fire on unarmed Indians, killing hundreds of them, that Gandhi completely abandons his faith in the empire. So at this stage, he's a liberal imperialist, if you will. Yeah.
He's a liberal imperialist. And what is his relationship with his family during the end of his time in South Africa? His wife gets involved in protest. One of his children gets involved in the protest. Tell us about that.
Yes, I think Gandhi had four sons. And the eldest son, who is an important figure in my book, is a man called Harilal. Harilal is born before Gandhi goes to London to study law. So the age difference between him and his father is only 18 years, because Gandhi had a child marriage. Now, it is when Gandhi is in his mid-30s, he's undergoing a midlife crisis. He's abandoning a prosperous and successful career at the bar for social activism. And Gandhi's midlife crisis coincides with his son's adolescent crisis. The son is 18 and 19, wants to educate himself. Gandhi says, no, education is useless. We are now struggling for the rights of our people. You must join me in jail. The son says, fine. Goes to jail once, twice, three times. One of the findings of my research was to discover Harilal's jail record in the National Archives in South Africa. So he's a heroic and successful passive resistor. But at some stage, he tells his father, I want to go back to India and I want to qualify as a barrister just as you did. And the father is very reluctantly allows him to go, but then calls him back to join the struggle. The father is also extremely disapproving of Harilal's passionate romantic relationship with his wife. Unlike the father, Gandhi, Harilal chooses his own wife. He falls in love with a girl, marries her. Gandhi's marriage is based more on obligation and reciprocity. Harilal's marriage is one of real intense love and passion, which also includes sexual passion. And Gandhi is critical of this. So in many ways, his treatment of his eldest son is the greatest failure of Gandhi's early life. I mean, he profoundly misunderstands the son, does not allow the son space to develop his own ideas, his own personality, imposes his own moral and political philosophy on the son, wants him to be a loyal follower of the father, and the son is broken by this.
I just want to go back that you describe Gandhi's political awakening as a midlife crisis. That's quite striking.
Yeah. Yes.
So then he chooses, he has renounced sort of a professional life as a barrister, as a lawyer, and now sees his life as one about social action. He chooses to leave South Africa, though. What's behind that choice?
Well, I think when Gandhi went to South Africa in 1893, he went to solve one case. He stayed 7 years, but then he goes back to India in 1901, as I describe in my book, tries to reestablish himself as a lawyer in Bombay. He's called back to South Africa because the Boer War has ended and the Indians in South Africa want Gandhi to represent them to get them rights in the new post-war dispensation. But he regards his exile or as temporary. You know, his life in the diaspora he doesn't see it as permanent. And in 1904-5, he tries to forge a compromise that fails. If the compromise worked, Gandhi would have gone back. So for a very long time, Gandhi wants to go back to India. And I argue, and I believe, that after Gandhi launches his first successful struggles in South Africa, and he recognizes the power he has to command loyalty and obligation, and that he's a leader, the ambition grows in him that I need a wider and larger stage for my political activism. In South Africa, I can never be more than the leader of the Indian diaspora, of 150,000 Indians in this multiracial country. Whereas back home in India, there's a much larger canvas. I mean, I can become the leader of an entire nation in the making. So from about 1906-07, he is possessed with the idea of returning to India. But he only returns after he secured the Indians in South Africa some minimum human rights. And after the struggle of 1913-14, where thousands of people caught arrest, including Gandhi's wife and children, and a kind of agreement is forged between the South African authorities and the Indians, lifting some of the most onerous restrictions, he goes back. But although Gandhi never says this explicitly in his autobiography or elsewhere, my surmise and my speculation is that Gandhi returns because he wants a larger stage to enact his political philosophy.
And his political philosophy at that point, at that decision, does he know what he wants for India, what change he's after?
Well, he knows that he wants to work in India. He has a mentor who is a remarkable liberal thinker called Gokhale, G.K. Gokhale, who visits him in South Africa, who is based in the Western Indian city of Pune. And Gokhale tells Gandhi that when Gandhi comes back, he says, for a year, you shall not make any political pronouncement. You will just travel around your country and seek to understand it, because you've been away 20 years. You don't know India. It's very different from South Africa. So he's not very clear about what direction his work will take, which is why he gives himself a year to study conditions on the ground before he actually jumps into political action.
So he arrives back in India knowing that he has the tactics to make it work, knowing he has the potential to make something happen, but doesn't quite know what quite yet.
Exactly. But I'd say one thing he does know, Anna, is he knows that any movement against the British would be nonviolent. He also knows, and I think this is very important, that it's crucial that he tries to forge good relations between Hindus and Muslims, the two major religious communities in India, who have a history partly of cooperation and compromise, but partly of conflict and struggle and feuding and blood feuding. And in South Africa, one of his great successes, he's able to get Hindus and Muslims and Parsis and Christians on a common platform. And he knows that when he comes back to India, one of his major tasks would be to forge a non-violent struggle of solidarity. But an even more important task, arguably, would be to build relations of trust and harmony between Hindus and Muslims.
We've been speaking about Gandhi before India, the first in a series of biographies by Ramachandra Guha about Mahatma Gandhi. Thank you so much for joining us in studio today. The book is published by Knopf.
Thank you.
Thank you.